Okay, let's get started. I still have a few of your quizzes, but they're in my office now, so if you want to get them, you've got to come to my office. So if you haven't picked up your quiz yet, that's the option. Very quickly, I said today we're going to talk about the loose ends. So today's pre-class test is designed around those loose ends. So four very, very quick questions that kind of cut to the core of what we're going to talk about today. So here's the first one. So you're looking at a company with a very large cash balance. You can put whatever name you want in the company. And the analyst who's looking at the company says, this company is going to be punished because cash earns a much lower return than the company's cost of capital. First, is that statement true? That cash earns a lower return than the company's cost of capital? If it's usually cash, it's called cash on the balance sheet, it's invested in where? Riskless liquid assets, right? So it's almost a truism. Of course cash earns less than your cost of capital. If we punish companies for doing that, every company that holds cash is destroying value, right? So what's the reason that statement is false? It has to be false. If it were true, then the optimal cash balance for every company should be zero. So what's wrong with that statement? Yes, sir. Let's not even go there. It's not. So if you bring in whatever other uses for the cash, it's a different issue. I'm just saying that I want that statement to be disproved, Rajiv. But well, even if you do that, there is so that doesn't. That's a mechanical way we deal with it. But the question is, why is cash not destroying value if it's making only 0.2%? What's the rule in capital budgeting? What do you compute the net present value for a project? You take the cash flows on the project and you discount it back at what? At a discount rate that reflects the riskiness of the project, right? Let's bring capital budgeting to play here. How risky is this investment you've made the cash in? Zero. So if you're investing in something riskless, what do you need to make? The riskless rate. Hey, guess what? 0.2% is not, in fact, I've given you this very simple test to apply before with cash. If you were investing cash today, risklessly and in a liquid investment, how much money are you making on that cash? If you're making 7%, please let me know where you've invested this cash. I'd love to join you. But this morning I was looking at at the cash in my portfolio, and it's making, I think, the last year I was doing my taxes. And I made 0.13% on the cash portion of my portfolio. If I sat there and said, that's a terrible investment, I should be making 9%, that's a required rate of return on stocks, it's not fair. So the notion that cash destroys value is okay, but you've got to base it on something stronger than it earns a lower return than what you could make as your cost of capital. The cost of capital is the rate of return for an investment with operating risk in it, reflecting the risk of the business. Cash is not that investment. So we'll come back and talk about why you might discount cash, but this is the bad reason for doing it. There are good reasons we'll talk about. Now let's take a second example. Company A owns 60% of Company B, and the financial statements are consolidated. I'll let your mind kind of deal with what that even means, because you have to remember you're accounting on this one. If these financial statements are used to estimate cash flows and value, so using the consolidated financial statements, how much of Company B will be incorporated in your value? You see the question I'm asking? You take the financial statements, you project earnings and cash flows, you discount them back at a reasonable cost of capital, you come up with the present value, right? You come up with the value of something. How much of Company B will be in that value? 100%. And why 100%? And so after you're done with the valuation, what do you need to do then to clean up for the fact that you own only 60%?
You have to take out 40%.
You have to value the 40%. This is something we're going to deal with today, because when you consolidate statements, this is exactly what's going to happen to you, is you've brought in all of Company B when in fact you own only 60% of Company B. So the first thing we have to do is deal with those majority holdings. What if Company A owns 10% of Company B and you use the income financial statements to estimate operating cash flows and cost of capital and value? How many of Company B is incorporated, reflected in that value. Yes? You'd like it to be 10%. Unfortunately, it's not. And here's why. When you own 10% of a company, you know how it shows up? It shows up below the operating income line as a income from your minority investment. So if you're working with operating income and free cash flow, if you have a minority holding, it's not there. So actually, if you own 60%, you've overcounted. If you own 10%, it doesn't show up at all. So today we're going to talk about cross-holdings, and I'll make a confession up front. It is the most confusing, confounding part of valuation, is valuing companies with cross-holdings. And I'll take you through the process of valuing Yahoo, which right now is just a collection of cross-holdings, and how, if you don't deal with it, you really can't even value the company. Yes, sir. What do you mean industry practice? Are we doing? No, we're doing a discounted cash flow valuation. So you can get an enterprise value. We can talk about what to do that. And you can add back the money. But this is, when you're doing an intrinsic valuation, none of that stuff even matters, right? Because you're working from the cash flows up. We'll talk about, when you do enterprise value, how people try to deal with that problem, right? They do try, but they do it very badly. And we'll talk about why adding that minority interest doesn't do the trick for you. Now let's talk about, you're done with the valuation. You projected the cash flows. You took extreme care. You discounted back at a cost of capital. You come up with the value of the business. Now you're looking around to mop up to make sure you haven't missed anything. I'm going to list some items for you, and you tell me whether you would add this on to your discounted cash flow valuation or ignore it. Okay, so this is actually a very tough test because you finished your DCF valuation. I'm now throwing assets at you and say, would you add that? Would you add that? How about the value of the headquarters building for this company in New York City? So that's a very valuable piece of asset, right? Very valuable real estate. Would you add it on? In where? In other words, the people sitting in that headquarters building were the people who generated cash flows. We'll come back and talk about this because this is, I think, becoming an incredibly messy part of valuation, especially in Asia. And here's why. The real estate values have shot up so much that there are some companies in Asia that the value of the operating assets is less than the real estate value alone of that headquarters building you're in. That's a tricky place to be because you ignore it. We say, what about that $10 billion piece of real estate you own? But you're right, you'd ignore it, and the rationale would be it's already there. Use that rationale if it's already counted. How about vacant land owned by the company in New York City? In what? In other words, you did the PP&E, so you should be able to know whether it's included or not, right? So if you plan to build a factory on that land 2 years from now, and you built in only the factory cost, and you're saying it's already included, but when you look through your CapEx numbers, you haven't really done anything with that land, that is a vacant asset. You're saying, look, I haven't counted in my... You see what we're basically going to have to do? With every asset, that's a question we have to ask. Is it already in the cash flows? And because you're the one who estimated the cash flows, you should know. And if you don't know, you need to take a closer look at your cash flows. How about patents? You look at a technology firm, pharmaceutical firm. Should I be adding the value of patents? And Joseph, why not? And the minute you say that, you know what I'm going to come back to is show me where, right? So be careful. Whenever you have these things, I agree with you. You should have included them. But you have to then think through where in my cash flows I include them. Because there's going to be somebody ask you, hey, why aren't we adding that? And you have to say, this is where in the cash flows we counted it. And the way it might show up, if it's a patent that's already commercially developed, it's easy, right? It's in your revenues, margins, etc. But if it's a patent that's been undeveloped, you say, I counted it when I did my growth in the next 10 years, and that's where it's captured. But the obligation will come back to you to explain how it's already been counted. How about brand name? Increasingly, accountants are trying to estimate values for brand names and put them on the balance sheet. And I know people who do DCF valuation and add the value of the brand name. What do you think, Perrine?
I don't think it should be included.
And why not?
Because it should already be accounted for in...
You see the common theme? It's already in there, should be your answer, right? Whenever it's already in there, and you're saying, where is it? It's in your margins, it's in your revenues. If you're doing Coca-Cola, those revenues and margins didn't come out of that great-tasting beverage you're creating. If that is the delusion you're operating under, let it go. Because 30 years ago, you did operate under the delusion. You came up with the new Coke, old Coke stuff. This came from your brand name. So if I now add the brand name, you have, now do you see why I'm terrified of where fair value accounting is going to take us? Because you're going to see all these items start to pop up on the balance sheet. I'm going to ignore them, and I think they should be ignored, but there are going to be people who say, oh, you know what, I forgot that asset, let me add that on. So if you've done a valuation, and we'll come back and talk about this more explicitly, as to how much of your value comes from the brand name, you shouldn't be adding the value of the brand name. Yes, sir. It's everywhere, right? So for the next 10 years, when you had growth, what was the value of that growth? It came from the fact that you earned more than your cost of capital. So if you have a strong brand name, you'll have a high margin, high return on capital, high. So it's not just the term, it's all through, it's everywhere, right? That's why taking out the effect of brand name is not just a terminal value effect, it'll change the entire value of the company. And that's the process I'll take Coca-Cola and see what happens if you took out the value of the brand name. And you're going to be horrified at how much the value disappears. Because what you're going to be left with is an oversweetened beverage that really doesn't taste that good and could not survive on its own, but it's held up by having this incredibly valuable brand name. How about goodwill? This should be a no-brainer, right? It's not even an asset. It's a plug variable, right? It's even worse than the other assets. It's a made-up asset. What if your CEO has been accumulating Picassos like crazy, using company money? Technically, it's yours. Don't do anything stupid, like saying, can I borrow a Picasso for a couple of days? But it does belong to the company. So that hunting lodge, paintings, whatever little baubles the CEO might accumulate, might effectively be part of the company. The problem is no company will ever admit to having these assets. I mean, what company is going to say, our CEO has been going crazy buying all this neat stuff for himself? So it's that's the one asset in this group that you got to say, maybe I should be including it. Rajiv?
Just a question on the number A. So right. you said that you wouldn't include the value of the headquarters, but I mean, at the extreme, if you have a real estate firm.
Can I come back to that? Because I can see exactly where you're going, which is if the value of a company is coming primarily from real estate, then if I ignore real estate, what do I do? It's a big issue, not just with real estate firms. You take a hotel company, which hasn't spun off its properties as a REIT. It's as much real estate play as it is a hotel play, right? So you can value it as a hotel company, you can value it as a real estate. You actually can get two different valuations. The real estate value can actually be higher than the operating asset value. It's a big problem, as I said, across large parts of the world. We'll talk about a way, at least, in which you can make that judgment. Yes? If you can show me that white tiger that you have in the casino basement is part of your operations, I'm not going to count the white tiger as one of my assets because it isn't operating. It goes back to that question. If you can connect it, say, this is connected to my cash flows. You know, every Trump building, let's face it, that gold cover is fake gold to begin with. But even with real gold, it's kind of an overdoing the whole thing, right? So unless you can show me people are willing to pay 20% more in leases and rents because of a gold-covered building, I'm starting to ask, maybe I should strip the gold off the building and sell it. No?
Right. So if we're talking about priceless pieces of art hanging in the resorts, would we...
The question is, if I replace them tomorrow with pale imitations, I bought them in Canal Street, will anybody even notice? Okay. That's really the question. I mean, you can give me all these stories you want. The reality is somebody walking through a resort is not saying, that's a real Picasso. So maybe we're spending tens of millions of dollars. It's a question of, is this the most efficient way to keep your resorts full is by putting real Picassos in the wall. So we'll come back to it. It really goes back to, does it really show up in cash flows? And is this the most efficient way of getting those cash flows? Yes, John?
Can you just go back to goodwill for a second and the extreme resilience that companies have, despite incredible evidence suggesting that you need to impair goodwill and then not doing it?
You know what? I think, first, a lot of company CFOs were accountants in a previous lifetime. To them, it's really hard to let go. They think balance sheets actually matter. They think people care about book value of equity. And you can tell them till they're blue in the face that nobody cares what your book equity is. There are incredibly valuable companies with negative book equity, but then they pull out their inner Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett's been a big believer. Look, Warren Buffett believes in book equity. You're not Warren Buffett. Stop waving that around with me. Your book equity, but they're so concerned. And here's the other thing. Why can't the Yankees let A-Rod go? Well, let's face it, he's a distraction right now, right? It's true, they owe him $66 million, but they're probably better off letting him go and eating the $66 million. But the minute you say, I'm letting him go, you're admitting to a mistake. Everybody knows you made a mistake, but that is the admission of a mistake. It's huge in behavioral finance. The act of admitting to a mistake is so painful that people will choose not to admit to the mistake. So that's why you hold on to losers for too long. You know you should be selling the stock, but the act of selling, okay, and the same thing is true for goodwill. You overpaid on that acquisition. That impairment, you know, is not going to affect your price now, but that impairment is the admission that you screwed up. So it's more psychological than anything else. Is people hate to admit mistakes, especially really big mistakes, and this is the admission of a mistake. Okay? So you've each picked a company to value, I think, right? And some of your companies are easier to value than others. But let's suppose that I have three companies. Company A, single business, transparent financials. Company B, complex business, is a complex with multiple businesses, opaque financials, or two businesses. I want you to start thinking about this. Okay? If you're valuing these companies, let's say their financials look exactly the same, would you value the simpler firm more highly or the complex firm more highly? This is the question I'm asking. Let's say the numbers look the same, but one company is simple and transparent, the other company is complex and opaque. Simple company? Nick, what do you think? I agree with that. That's exactly what my next question was. Because instinctively, I know the complex firms hold surprises. But you think about how we've computed cash flows, growth rates, discount rates, terminal value. Nowhere in there was there a way for us to bring in the effect of complexity. Another loose end I want to talk about, because clearly that is a hole in what we've done. Because I agree with you. I wanted to pay less. But there's nothing in my intrinsic toolkit right now that allows me to do it. And that makes me uncomfortable because I know I should somehow be factoring that in. When I value News Corp, that there is a lot more I don't know that is going to affect me in the valuation. So let's bring all of those things. As I said, today we're going to talk about all those issues. So let me go back to... I think we were on page 192. I just listed out the loose ends. So here are some of the loose ends I want to talk about today. I want to start with cash. We kind of talked about why you shouldn't be punishing cash just because it earns a low return. We'll talk about good reasons why you might punish cash in the hands of some companies. Then I want to talk about cross holdings. We talked about majority-minority holdings. I want to talk about other assets. What other assets should I be adding on? Non-operating assets. I get to the value of the firm. I want to talk about complexity, the issue we talked about. Is there a way I can bring it into my valuation? If there's synergy, intangibles, we'll come back and talk about that in the context of acquisitions. And I also want to talk about, if I get a chance, how equity compensation, we kind of dance around this issue, how does it affect the value that you pay for a company? The fact that companies pay their managers with shares or with restricted shares or options. So I want to factor all of that in, and let's start with cash. The rule with cash is very simple, right? Right from the beginning I said don't play games. If there's $100 million in cash, it's worth $100 million. But let me go back and revisit that. In many equity valuations, we tend to mangle cash, especially when you take net income and you discount back at the cost of equity and do all that neat stuff. But I'm going to take you to a very simple hypothetical. And I want you to step back from all the valuation stuff we talked about and think like an investor. I'm going to show you three companies. The three companies look exactly identical in terms of how much they have as value for the operating assets. You've taken cash flows and discounted the cost of capital. They come up with $1 billion each, and they all each have $100 million in cash. Let's assume the cash is not contested. There's really $100 million in each of the companies. But here's where they're different. Company A has a return on capital of 10% and a cost of capital of 10%. It's a developed market company. Company B has a return on capital historically of 5%, cost of capital of 10%. It's a developed market company. And company C has a return on capital of 22%, well above its cost of capital. It's an emerging market company. I'm going to tell you up front that in these three companies, I think in one of these three companies, cash is going to be a neutral asset. You know what I mean by a neutral asset? $100 million. It's going to be valued at $100 million. In one of these three companies, you're likely to discount cash in the hands of the company. And in one of these companies, you might actually attach a premium to the cash. You're going to treat $100 million as worth more than $100 million. Let's start with the easy one. Which of these three companies is cash most likely to be a neutral asset? Deepa there. And what is it about company A that makes it neutral?
The return on capital and the cost of capital are the same.
It's what I call a blah company, right? What do blah companies do? They don't hurt you. They don't help you. They're going to run in place. But before you complain about blah companies, there are fates far worse than investing in a blah company. Let me ask you the tough question, or maybe not so tough question. Which of these three companies are you most likely to discount cash in the hands of the company? I hear a few B's and I hear a C. Rajiv? And what is it about B that scares you?
Because they're going to take that cash, which is now zero in B, and they're going to deploy it at a negative.
In fact, it's not the cash itself that worries you. It's what these guys might do with the cash. Because what's their history? Is whenever they found a way to invest, they found a way. You're attaching a stupidity discount. That's what you're doing, right? You're saying, these guys are so stupid. I know they find a way to screw this up. And given their history, I have to assume that they will screw up at least 20%. You think, that is absurd. Hey, come on. If HP held your cash, wouldn't you discount it in their hands? I said, no, you can see it coming. It's almost written in the script that 2 years from now, they're going to find some screwed up acquisition to do and pay $8 billion more than they should. They've done it before, and they'll do it again. It's not cash itself that worries you. It's what the company will do with the cash. Now let me take company C. It's tricky because you're faced with this issue. If it's an emerging market, there's corporate governance issues. I don't know whether the cash actually exists. Maybe they're stealing from me, et cetera, et cetera. But let's go back to corporate finance 101. In traditional corporate finance, no company needs a cash balance. You're saying, why not? Because if you have a great project, you know what I assume you can do? Go to capital markets, raise the capital, take the project. Capital markets are open and accessible. No company needs cash. Now let's flip that around. Where did I put this company? Argentina, right? Open and accessible capital markets. Are you kidding me? This is a country where every 5 years, everything shuts down. Not just equity markets, but banks stop lending. Now do you see why having cash in a market which can shut down, where capital is not accessible, could be a strategic weapon? Not just so that you can survive the next crisis, which is coming, but also because you can use the cash to buy assets from other companies that are truly desperate for the cash. In emerging markets, and it doesn't even have to be emerging markets. Think about in late 2008, being a U.S. company. Your buffer against the crisis was having a lot of cash because you did not have to go to... GE couldn't issue commercial paper in November of 2008. So when capital markets become inaccessible, cash becomes a strategic weapon. So what I'm opening the door to is the traditional practice in valuation. Just take the cash balance and add it. I'm saying that might or might not be the right approach for your company, depending on its history. For 80% of companies, if you did that, I'd say, you know what, barring anything spectacular, that's reasonable. But there are some companies we're going to look at the cash and say, in this company, I have to be careful, especially if 20, 25, 30% of the company is coming from the cash. You got to think about, will that cash get discounted in the hands of the company? There's actually a tax reason for discounting cash as well, which we've kind of talked about earlier. Apple is $176 billion in cash, right? You know, what's the tax reason? We've kind of mentioned this earlier. $110 billion of that $176 billion is offshore trap cash, which there is a potential. So there's another discounting effect, but that's a much more explicit discounting effect. That's got nothing to do with stupidity, but the fact that the cash has a tax liability. Yes?
So if this is based on ROC, COC, and kind of like a prolonged competitive advantage.
Disadvantage. Prolonged. Are you talking about the premium?
Argentina.
Yeah.
For the Argentinian company. How is this not factored into our DCF?
It is factored in for future cash flow. So you're building in all that growth value. But this is about an existing cash balance, right? So you can do all the good stuff in your cash flows, but this is your existing cash balance is actually worth more than you think it is because of that capital access constraint, and that's what gives it a premium. Sounds outlandish. Do markets actually do it? I want to show you the results of a study. This is actually a fascinating study, and here's what these people did. They looked across U.S. companies, and they asked a very simple question. How much is a dollar in cash valued at in the hands of a company? How does the market value cash? I'll give you the good news first, and then I'll give you the semi-good news later. Across all U.S. companies, a dollar in cash is valued at roughly a dollar. You see why that's good news? Because that's what we do in valuation. But then when they focused in on mature companies with negative excess returns, which is what? These are companies that earn less than the cost of capital, like Company B. A dollar in cash is actually valued at 69 cents. That's an astonishing discount. So what am I telling you? You're a mature company with a bad track record with $10 billion in cash. The market acts like you have only $6.9 billion. I've talked a little bit about Carl Icahn off and on. I don't have a great deal of respect for his corporate finance acumen. But I have a great deal of respect for his targeting acumen. He picks the right companies. And what I mean by the right companies is, do you see the advantage of an ICANN targeting this company? What did I say? They have $10 billion in cash. The market's valuing it at $6.9 billion. So all the company has to do is do what? Give the, not even the difference, just give the cash back, the whole thing. You think, I can't take projects. Good. GM's stock price jumped yesterday when they returned $10 billion in cash. There are all these sob stories about how terrible this is for GM because they can't compete with Ford and Volkswagen. Who wants to be in this rotten business? Get out of the business now, because the automobile business collectively is a crapshoot. No wonder the stock price went up, saying, thank God they didn't find something to put this $10 billion in. Don't worry, the money will find its way elsewhere. This is not money leaving the system. It's finding a different place. Maybe it'll go into Tesla. Because after all, Elon Musk has these plans to make Tesla the next Apple, right? At least that's what he told us. No? So maybe he needs a capital. But you can see markets punishing some companies. And this is actually, if you look at Apple over the last 3 or 4 years, this has actually been a big part of the price value dance we've seen. Is over some periods, about 2 years ago, Apple's cash balance was being discounted by the market. I thought it was unfair because Apple did not have the kind of track record that Company B did or HP did, because it didn't have a history of doing stupid big acquisitions. But markets were building in that discount, and I felt it was unfair for that discount. That discount has now gone away, but it doesn't mean it's gone away for good, because you're always one mistake away from being reassessed. But that's with mature firms that earn less than the cost of capital. When they focused on high-growth firms that earn well above the cost of capital, many of them small, a dollar in cash was actually valued at $1.22. So the next time you see somebody jump on a company saying, you have a really big cash balance, step back and look at the company. If it's a young, risky company, a technology company, cash actually is a good thing. Markets don't punish you for holding cash. They might actually reward you, because this is what's going to let you survive the next downturn. So cash is not as simple as it looks from the outside, because we don't live in a market with open and free access to capital, and cash can let you survive. Rajiv?
Yeah. Is it fair to say that the cash has an option value?
Exactly. In fact, we're going to value it exactly that way. We're going to value it as an option. And the greater the option value, in fact, we can kind of build the foundations for it. When is option value greatest? When you have a lot of uncertainty. So if you're in a risky business with limited access to capital, and there are tremendous return opportunities potentially out there, cash acts exactly as an option. And the greater the option value, the more cash you should hold. Okay? Now let's take a little tangent from you, because there are a couple of things we can use to this cash discussion to talk about. Heard of closed-end funds? You know how mutual funds are set up, right? If you invest in Fidelity Magellan, what happens? You send your money into Fidelity Magellan. The number of shares expands when money comes in. Okay? And you get your share of the net asset value of the fund. So open-end funds, you take the total value of the fund, everybody gets a share of that net asset value. 90%, perhaps even more, of mutual funds are open-end funds. But there's a subset of funds called closed-end mutual fund funds, closed-end mutual funds, which actually trade in the market. They're traded as companies. Their assets are marketable securities. So they own Coca-Cola, American Express. So basically, you can see what they own. You can see the market prices of what they own. These should be very simple companies to value, right? It's right there. These are the eight companies we own. These are how many shares. You multiply by the price, you get the net asset value of the funds. But what corporate finance likes to call a puzzle, the typical closed-end fund trades at a discount of about 15 to 20% on that net asset value. Strange, right? Because already, what's your mind saying? Arbitrage. In what way? Go buy the fund, liquidate it, claim the shares. Well, there are little roadblocks in there, but it's still a puzzle. Why would you have a company that's that simple to value being discounted? Any theories as to why a typical closed-end fund is discounted? What do we say drives whether you discount cash? Whether you earn your required return, right? You throw in effect. How much does the average active portfolio manager beat the market by each year? They don't, right? We threw that question out first. So if you earn 1% less than the index, that's like earning negative excess returns, right? You see the opening that I'm going to use to explain the typical discount? Let's say you took an average closed-end fund, or a closed-end fund that actually invests in average risk stocks. Let's suppose, based on the average risk, they need to make 11.5% a year. That's their required return, based on the beta, the risk-free rate, the equity risk-free rate. Let's say you expect them to underperform by 0.5%, based on the history, which is not bad, right? Given the rest, that's actually not bad, given the average active. How much would you discount? How much would the discount on this fund be? Let's say you invest $100 in this fund. How much are you going to make each year?
It comes out to around like 5%.
Yeah, basically.
You're earning only 11% per year, so like $100 per year.
$11. And what did you discount the 11 at?
11.5%.
So you just treat it as a perpetuity. $11 a year in perpetuity, discount at 11.5%, you come up with $96 or $96.40, which means that if you underperform the market by 5.5%, your discount is going to be about 3.7%. If you underperform the market by 1%, so if I expect you to underperform, the way it's going to show up is as a discount on your net asset value. So maybe this isn't a mystery anymore. Maybe the reason closed-end funds get discounted is because we expect them to underperform the market. We have a basis for doing that. Look at the rest of the business. What happens if you have a closed-end fund that you expect to outperform the market? It's got this great manager. What should happen? Well, if you underperform the market, you have a discount. So if you outperform, there should be a premium, right? You read the Berkshire Hathaway letter? 50th anniversary, big one, right? Take a look at it. It's really interesting to read. What's Berkshire Hathaway? It's originally a shirt company, right? Which, it's really an insurance company. That's the big piece. There are all these little pieces like See's Candy, but they're like nothing. It's an insurance company with a really great portfolio manager. It's a closed-end fund on the other side. Every insurance company actually is a closed-end fund in a sense, because the money you collect from your premiums gets invested. In most insurance companies, a closed-end fund doesn't create value. But in the case of Berkshire Hathaway, clearly it has. In fact, if you take Berkshire Hathaway and you take their assets, they're all mostly in publicly traded stocks like Coca-Cola. You can actually add up the market values. And one of the fascinating things about Berkshire Hathaway is, for the longest time, The market value of Berkshire Hathaway was significantly higher than their book value, which you think, what's the big deal? Lots of companies do that. But in this case, the book value was actually, it was almost like if you could buy Coca-Cola at $35 and you bought Berkshire Hathaway, you were paying $60 for a $35 stock, because that's effectively what you were doing, is you were paying that substantial premium. Doesn't make you crazy, because you were getting what you felt at least was the best portfolio manager of all time, right? But if you take a look at the 50 years, it's actually fascinating, because he gives you all 50 years of his history. And you graph it out. The first 25 years, it's a no contest. It's the excess returns are huge. The price-to-book value ratio is well above what a typical insurance company trades at. Starting about 15 years ago, you start to see the market value start to drift down towards the book value. In other words, the premium he's paying for Berkshire Hathaway is getting smaller. We can debate how much smaller. But today, Berkshire Hathaway's price-to-book ratio is not that different from that of a typical insurance company. So here's my question. Why, if you're willing to pay a premium then for the Warren Buffett manager stamp, are you not willing to do it now? Well, it's not even if he doesn't have to retire, right? He's 85 years old. You could check his own mortality tables at Geico. And this, I'm not being morbid, but this, it's a reality. Even if he said, I'm going to hang around, well, the clock is ticking, right? That's part of it. There's another part that I think will get me into trouble, but I think Warren Buffett would have a tough time being Warren Buffett in this market. The kind of investment philosophy that made him so successful is a philosophy that is running into headwinds for a couple of reasons. One is, what's the milieu that he's most what types of companies has he historically been most comfortable with? Kind of companies, tangible products, old-fashioned companies, book value means something. So you can go down the list. And the market increasingly is shifting away from those companies into different spaces. And he's never been. So a bigger and bigger choice. So he said, I will never be in technology. Not a big deal 30 years ago, but today if you say, I'm never going to be in technology, that might be not just 20% of the market, but it might be 40 or 50%, because even Tesla has a technology component. I don't understand that. So a big chunk of the market is moving away from it. The second is that 25 years ago, the rule in value investing was just invest in your company, value your company, don't worry about macro stuff. You're in a developed market. The macro stuff can't make that much of a difference, because everything reverts back to the way it used to be. Today, that is no longer the case. If you make one big macro bet that goes wrong, even unintentionally, it can wipe you out. So that big railroad investment you made was indirectly an investment in oil prices, right? Because a big chunk of your revenues as a railroad now comes from transporting energy from one part of the country to another. So I'm not saying he's become a bad manager, but I think that this is a different, and even if he were only 55 years old, I think you'd have started to see the premium start to shrink. But it's a very interesting twist on closed-end funds is to think about Berkshire Hathaway. So if you want my email today, I'll send you the financials. I pulled it off Capital IQ. You can do it yourself, of market cap and book value and net income. And you can then graph out how the numbers have started converging, especially in the last 10 or 15 years. So that's the first stop. Any questions about cash or closed-end funds? Yeah.
Sorry, just going back a little bit. When we're talking about the returns on closed-end funds, we're talking net of fees.
Net of fees, yeah. Okay. Net of fees. So the 0.5% is net of fees.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay.
If you didn't have the fees, you probably would just break even.
Okay. They're making maybe like 12.5% or something like that, 1% in fees.
If you're lucky. No, this is because they're probably making 11.5% and 0.5% off in fees. So basically, that's probably it, is you're running in place thinking you're beating the market when in fact you are just keeping up. So the typical closed-end fund probably is not run by a genius or even a super investor, just an average investor. Well, that's up to you. You know? So it's there are people obviously who do, no? but they do exist. No? Let's talk about cross-holding. Yeah, Nick. No, just make sure it's the consequence of handling cash badly in a high inflation environment is much worse. There's more downside risk. So if you have cash sitting around as currency and inflation is 10%, you're going to devastate yourself. That's why you go into emerging markets with high inflation. cash is the most well-managed asset on the balance sheet. In the early 1990s, every Brazilian company became a financial service company on the side because they made more money more efficiently on their cash than they did on all their operations. It's very unhealthy, actually, because it's easier to run your paper business than it is to run, your cash business than it is to run your operating business. So there's not much upside you get from having cash and high inflation, but there's potentially downside if you don't keep your cash working constantly. Let's talk about cross-holdings. The first challenge with cross-holdings is getting over the accounting hurdle, because there are three ways in which cross-holdings are accounted for. And let's see if your accounting kind of triggers as you go along. And these three ways exist in both IFRS and in GAAP, so they apply, but there are mild differences. The first is if you own a very small piece of a company, 2, 3, 4% of a company, you take absolutely no role in how that company is run. It's classified as a minority passive investment. You're saying, so what? If you have a minority passive investment, here's what you have to show in your income statement. So let's say you own 4% of a company. You have to show 4% of the dividends you receive from that company, and that's it. So basically, you show the dividends in your income statement, you're done. And in your balance sheet, you have to show what you originally invested to get this 4%. Talk about disconnect with reality, right? I'll give you two examples. In the late 90s, SoftBank, now a Japanese venture capital company, was getting 70% of its value from one holding, its holding of Yahoo, in which it was a venture capitalist. This is a $10 billion company. $7 billion is coming from its, but it was classified as a minority passive holding. So if you looked at SoftBank's income statement, all you'd have seen is what? The dividends they were receiving from Yahoo in 1997, which is what? Nothing. You have seen nothing. You're saying, that's okay, I'll go look in the balance sheet. If you look in the balance sheet, you have seen a $50 million investment. That was your original VC investment in Yahoo. Fast forward 18 years. Now you look at Yahoo, and you look at their holdings in Alibaba, Yahoo, Japan. You're starting to see the same game play out. Minority passive investments are your worst case scenario. One step up, you own 15% of another company, you take some role, even a small role, in how that company is run. It's classified as a minority active investment. You have to use what's called the equity approach. You're saying, what the heck is that? In your income statement, rather than show dividends, you show 15% of the net income or net loss of the company flowing through. And in your balance sheet, you have to show what you originally invested, adjusted for any retained earnings since. It's like an adjusted book value. So a little better than minority passive, it's minority active. Let's move one step up the ladder. You get to 60% of a company, accountants flip out, right? You're required to do what in both IFRS and GAAP? You have to do consolidation, a process I've never understood. So here's what you tell me to do. You tell me to act like I own 100% of the company. You say, but I don't. You said, don't worry about it. Just act like you do. So I count 100% of your revenues, 100% of your operating income, 100% of your assets, 100% of your debt. Each stage, I'm saying, but I own only 60%. He said, don't worry about it. The last moment you wake up and say, but you own only 60%. Say, that's what I've been trying to tell you all this time. You don't own 40%. Exactly. We have to show the 40% that doesn't belong to you somewhere on the balance sheet. And hence is born the worst named item on the balance sheet, which is minority interest, because when you hear the term minority interest, you're not an accountant. You go to somebody on the street and say, I have a minority interest on my balance sheet. They say, congratulations, good job. But minority interest actually shows up on the liability side of the balance sheet. It reflects the 40% that doesn't belong to you, and it's there because we do consolidation. The first step in dealing with cross-holdings is understanding the accounting. Because if you don't understand the accounting, you're already lost, right? Is it a minority passive, minority active? And what's making it even murkier is you now are allowed to do partial consolidation for some kind of joint ventures, which means you can show those 60%, not the 100%. So already you can see the variance start to show up, and you need to know what variance your company is using before you can deal with them. So let's do a very simple exercise in valuing a company with cross holdings. And as we go through this exercise, you're already going to start to see why it's so difficult valuing a company with cross holdings. Let's say you valued company A using consolidated financials. So that's critical that you recognize consolidated. You came up with the value of $1 billion by discounting free cash flow to the firm at the cost of capital. It has $200 million in debt. So let's start easy. What's the value of equity in company? $1 billion minus $200 is $800 million, right? Everybody with me so far? Because now I'm going to start throwing the cross holdings at you, and you have to tell me what the effect will be. Now assume you're told that company A owns 10% of company B, and the holdings are accounted for as passive holdings. If the market cap for company B is $500 million, remember the $800 million you got before? Would you reassess your value in any sense? Add, subtract, do nothing? You see the question I'm asking? Have you already counted this?
Yeah.
Where? But remember, we did free cash flow to the firm, which comes from operating income. And this is a 10% holding of another company. So if you did operating income, it's not there yet, right?
You should add
50 million. You, but already you're starting to cross the line, right? Because you took an intrinsic valuation for step one, and now you've added a market value. If you're willing to live with that contradiction, keep going, right? So you're now 800 plus 50, we're at 850. Everybody with me so far? Now I'm going to throw in a third piece. Now, let's suppose I told you company A owns 60% of company B, C, and the holdings were the fully consolidated holdings. And so you look at company A's balance sheet, you know what you're going to see, right? Because it's consolidated, you see a minority interest of 40 million. What do you want me to do with the 40 million? Add, subtract, or ignore? Rajiv. And give me the rationale, why? Exactly.
But I just, the thing I was going to say, so that 40 million is a book value number. But
in fact, we have a complete mess, right? We took an intrinsic value in step one, we added a market value in step two, we subtracted an accounting value in step three, and we claim to have done an intrinsic valuation. This is how DCFs get done of cross-holding companies. And it drives me crazy, because if you're going to do intrinsic valuation, if you mix all these things up, I don't even know what you've created by the end, right? So if I were to do this right, what should I do, Rajiv?
I mean, if you could split out the 60% entity value that, then you take 60% of that and put it on your base holdings.
In other words, if I could do an intrinsic valuation of all three, A, B, and C, that might help you, right? So let's assume I did value company B doing an intrinsic valuation and came up with 250 million, and I told you the value of company C, intrinsic value is also 250 million. So now what did I do to make my valuation? I'm going to start with the 800 million like I did before. Then I'm going to do what? Add 10% of 250 million. That brings me to 825. And then last step, what do I need to do? Subtract out 40% of 250 million, which is 100, which will bring me down to 725. So do you see the difference between the two approaches? The first one I took the intrinsic value, then I added the market value of company B and subtracted out the accounting value of the 40%, creating a mess. But this requires that I value three companies. Now do you see why people don't want to go there? But if you're going to do an intrinsic valuation with substantial cross-holdings, that is what you would need to do, is value the parent company standing alone, value each of the individual pieces separately, then add the pieces up. It's going to be much more consistent. Rajiv. Let's put a rule. I mean, if it's not going to change your investment decision, which is 3, 4, 5% of a value, it doesn't change, then I'm not going to. So if you're a $50 billion company with a $500 million holding, or even a $1 billion holding, or even a $2 billion holding, it's not worth the effort. But once you start getting beyond that, it could start affecting your investment decision, then you've got to start thinking about how do I do this right. So I took Yahoo, and I decided to do an intrinsic valuation of Yahoo. I did this about a year ago on my blog because of all this noise around Yahoo. It was very difficult, especially before Alibaba went public, making sense of what Yahoo was actually worth. So here's what I did. I valued Yahoo's operations. And guess what? They're not worth much. And we knew that already, right? This is a search engine with no place to go, advertising that's shrinking, a model that's basically under siege. So this is Marissa Mayer's fiefdom, and she controls basically about $4 billion in operating asset value, about $7 billion. So if Yahoo were just a standalone business based on operations, that would be the value of the parent company. So this is Yahoo's parent company. They own 35% of Yahoo Japan, which is a publicly traded company. I could have used the market cap, but I didn't want to do that. I actually did an intrinsic valuation of Yahoo Japan, came up with a value of about 21 billion for the equity, and took 35% of that value. Then I valued Alibaba, which in the time that I did this valuation was still a private company, but I could still do an intrinsic valuation heading into its IPO, came up with a value of about 146 billion and took 22.1% of that. You add those three numbers up, you come up with a value of about 48 billion. But I have to be a realist because Yahoo invested in Alibaba way back in time and Yahoo Japan way back in time. You think, so what? If it ever cashes out on these investments, and some of it it's going to be forced to cash out because leading into the IPO, Alibaba actually required Yahoo to divest itself of about half of its holding. So this is not even a hypothetical. Will they have to do it? We know it's coming. I estimated the taxes due for that sale. Not on all of the holdings being sold off, but at least the portion they're going to be forced to sell off. The Yahoo options are on top of that. The value that I get, and this is a pure intrinsic valuation, sum of the parts valuation. So this is a true intrinsic value, sum of the parts. The value that I get per share was about $41.19. Three businesses. Yeah. Now, with three businesses, you can do this. I was able to do this because I could get the full financials for Yahoo US, Yahoo Japan, and Alibaba. In fact, I couldn't have done this 2 years ago because Alibaba had no... This was after Alibaba filed the prospectus for its IPO. I had the full financials. But this can sometimes become impractical when you have either some divisions or some businesses where you can't get to the financials, or you have a company with 50 holdings, 70 holdings, 100 holdings. I'll give you my favorite example. This was about 15 years ago. I was doing a second or third edition of one of my books. I was valuing a Japanese company. And Japanese companies are always teetering on the edge of disaster because the risk-free rate then used to be so low relative to everything else that if you use growth rates from elsewhere, it'll blow up the valuation. So I was very careful, very proud of myself. I get done, patting myself vigorously on the back. When I start reading the annual report, and it tells me that this company has 227 cross holdings. My eyes pop out, because if I were one of those hardworking, careful people, which I'm not, what's the next step in the process? If I were doing an intrinsic valuation, I should be valuing 227 other little companies. Now, I'm not that careful, and I'm not that hardworking. But even if I had been, here would have been the second problem. About 60 of those cross holdings were in public companies, so I could have done the financials and done the valuation, but 167 were private businesses, and there was no information, absolutely nothing on those companies. So I called the investment relations officer of this Japanese company and said, look, I'm valuing your company, I need some information on your cross holdings. She said, I cannot give you that information, it's proprietary. I said, okay, what if I bought 1,000 shares in your company and then called you? She said, it'd still be proprietary. I said, let me get this straight. I'll be part owner of your company. You're refusing to tell me what I own. Is this right? She thought about it for a moment and said, you have a point, but it's still proprietary. I said, what am I doing? Why am I banging my head against the wall? I get ready to hang up the phone. She says, no, wait. I do have something I can tell you about these cross holdings. So maybe she's going to give me some revenue numbers or operating income numbers. And I said, what? She said, I cannot give you any information on these cross holdings, but I have to tell you they're worth a lot. I said, what does that mean? How many zeros are there in a lot? But I think that cuts to the heart of the cross holding culture, because this is what managers do. They hold up a brown paper bag and say, trust me, it's full of cash. Can I look in the bag? No, it's full of cash. And if you say, okay, tell me how much cash there is, what incentive is there to ever let you look in the bag? So in many companies, doing this ground up approach of valuing the subsidiaries is not going to be practical. And many of you are going to find this for your company. If your company has cross holdings, you're going to find that you don't have the information to value the cross holdings. You're working with minimalist information, maybe revenues, maybe income, maybe book value. But rather than leave it at that book value, my suggestion is you try to estimate market value. I use a very simplistic device. If all I have is the book value of a holding you have in another company, and I know what business that holding is in, remember, book value can either be minority interest or the other side, so whichever side it is, I take that book value and apply the price-to-book ratio of companies in that sector. I know it's incredibly simplistic. It's bringing in pricing into the process, but it's better than using book value. If you have earnings or EBITDA for that cross-holding, if you can convert that into estimated value, go for it. It's better to have some estimated value rather than stick with book value for these cross-holdings. And in fact, I took Yahoo and I did a pricing of Yahoo rather than an intrinsic valuation. You're saying, what does that mean? I took Yahoo Japan. I took a market value of Yahoo Japan. I took Alibaba and I said if I applied a price earnings ratio. So in other words, it's a kind of a back of the envelope assessment of what Yahoo's parent company is worth if I price the other two. Here's a fascinating thing that you get. If you take Yahoo Japan and Alibaba and you price them based on what other companies in the market are trading at, the value that you get is actually $6 billion higher for just those two pieces than what you'd be paying for the entire company. I'll put more crudely, the market is attaching a value of minus $6 billion to Yahoo's U.S. operations. You're saying, how can that be? Well, you're either assuming that Marissa Mayer is going to find these really bad acquisitions to do that will wipe out the value of Yahoo US and more, or you're just being unrealistic. Okay? That was the basis. In fact, I mean, I said I'm buying Yahoo. This was way back when it was trading at 32 or 33. I said, not because I have a great deal of faith that the company is somehow going to turn around, but the pieces I'm getting here are so much more valuable than what I'm paying for the whole company that I don't see how it can play out. And since then, the game, of course, has continued. Alibaba went public to rapturous response. The price went up. In fact, at one point in time, I think the sum of the pieces gave me a value of about $55 to $60 for Yahoo. The stock was trading at 44. Yahoo since has taken its Alibaba holdings and spun it off. So if you're a Yahoo stockholder, you now own a piece of Alibaba, whether you want to or not. So there's some interesting games going on. But it's something to think about when you have a company where the bulk of your value comes from cross-holdings. You have to pay attention. So if I'm investing in Yahoo, it's really not about Yahoo US anymore. It's what I think about Alibaba and Yahoo Japan that's driving my assessment of how much I should pay for the company. Yes, Deepetra.
So the first way that you looked at it was like the intrinsic
value. Right.
This is like
this pricing.
A pricing approach.
That's basically it.
Could you say like this makes more sense if you are like
a trader
able to like short your exposure?
Yeah. That's exactly right. In fact, here's one way to do it, is you buy Yahoo, you sell short on Yahoo Japan and Alibaba. You can pretty much create a pretty close to, I wouldn't say risk-free because there are all these little, but you can make it a very low-risk investment and keep a lot of cash right up front, right?
Okay, so that would be like, then pricing would make more sense there.
Especially if the pieces are traded, as it is in Yahoo right now, you have Yahoo traded, you have Yahoo Japan and the one big wild card is the tax issue. And that's why in these last two reports, what people have been focusing on is what can Yahoo do to reduce that tax impact? Because it's going to be huge. Their investment in Alibaba, the cost basis is so low that it's almost all capital gains. And capital gains to a corporation gets taxed at an ordinary tax rate. So you don't have a capital gains tax rate even. So that's become the dance that you're dancing, is what kind of tax liability will I have? Because in your worst case scenario, the tax liability alone will explain away the difference between the pricing and what you're paying for Yahoo. But that assumes that everything gets divested now. You pay 40% of that income in taxes immediately. So whatever they can do to manage the tax liability to make it a smaller number will be beneficial for you. Okay. Any other questions? Now let's talk about, is there anything else I should be counting? Now, clearly, the key thing to remember here is you do not want to double count an asset. So you don't want to count something you've already counted in your cash flows. And that's why I threw all those different things at you. So 90% of what you see in the balance sheet that you want to count, you shouldn't be counting. It's already in there. Right? So what are the things you might count? You know how pension plans work at a corporation? There are two ways a pension plan can be set up. One is a defined contribution plan. How does that work? And what do you get back as pension? Nothing is promised. It's whatever you make. So defined contribution plan, the company has no liability. It just takes the money, invests it in whatever. So you pick Vanguard, they invest in Vanguard for you. A defined benefit plan is a different beast altogether. Because in a defined benefit plan, the company does what? it promises a fixed pension, right? Which means you have a liability stream, which you now have to set aside assets to cover. And every year, somebody's going to come in, an actuary is going to come in and value your assets and value your liabilities and tell you whether you're overfunded, correctly funded, or underfunded. If you're underfunded, you have a problem because it means you've got to come up with more assets. If you're correctly funded, then it passes through. And if you're overfunded, presumably as an equity investor, you're getting you put aside too much money. So if I gave you two companies which looked exactly alike, and one has an overfunded pension plan and the other has a correctly funded plan, which one would you value more? If it's overfunded, though, isn't that like a bonus for you? I mean, if you have too much money set aside into a pension, given that all the other numbers are the same, isn't it a benefit to have an overfunded plan? I think it is, but I don't know how to bring it in. I can't just add the overfunding and say it's mine because it's tax-wise, it's not an easy thing to take money. But where would I show that benefit that I have an overfunded plan? What is the benefit I get from having an overfunded plan as a company? Well, what I need to set aside. So the difference in the two companies is what these companies will have to set aside in the future. The cover pension contribution will be lower for the overfunded plan company, which presumably will increase my value. Not by a huge amount, but by some. So that's one typical asset that you might not have counted. We'll talk about what to do if you have an underfunded plan a little later, because that's the other problem, right? Cuts in the other direction. But let's think about any other assets out there that you might want to count. Let's start with, let me give you an example. This is from back in time. It's kind of an offbeat example, but I kind of bring home the point. You heard of the Michael Price Fund, right? Anybody here in the Michael Price Fund? You're in the Michael Price Fund. I was actually one of the original. I hate asking people for money. I don't know how I got pulled into this group that went to Michael Price and asked for this money. But Michael Price originally, he gave this money because he sold his mutual fund to the Japanese for a vastly higher price than they should have paid. So he felt really, you know. No, but the fact is he had hundreds of millions of dollars. And we said, can you give us some money at Stern so MBAs can manage some money? And that, of course, was the heart of the Michael Price Fund. I have never officially been involved with the Michael Price Fund, but lots of people in this class have gone through the fund. And once in a while, I'll get people come by and try their pitches on me. I'm going to pitch this to the fund. Can you tell me whether there's any obvious hole that you see in my pitch? It's about 7 or 8 years ago. One of the people in the fund comes in and he says, I'm facing a conundrum. I'd look up on my computer exactly what he was talking about, but it turned out he's just confused. But I said, that's a nice word. I like to use it. So I decided to use it as often as I could with him. I said, what's your conundrum? He said, I'm valuing Playboy. And I said, I don't see a conundrum yet. You can see how many times I was going to throw it in. He says, I valued Playboy at $240 million. It's trading at $280 million. And I said, still don't see a conundrum. You valued it at $240. It's trading at $280. Don't buy it. He said, but there's one big asset that Playboy has that I haven't counted in my value. It's the Playboy Mansion. Have you ever been driven by the Playboy Mansion in L.A.? It's a huge property. By some estimates, it's worth $80 to $100 million. And it belongs to Playboy, the company, but it doesn't show up in anywhere in the numbers. So I said, what do you want to do? He said, should I be counting the $100 million? And I said, you really can't do it right now because there is an 85-year-old in a bathrobe who seems to be hanging out there that you can't exactly throw out in the street without some serious PR problems. And I'm talking about Hugh Hefner. He said, what should I do? I said, why don't you check the actuarial tables? Same actuarial table check for Warren Buffett. This time you're checking for what? An 85-year-old in a bathrobe who hangs out around 26-year-old playmates, right? This is not good for your heart. I'm sure this will reduce your lifespan substantially. Let's say you come up with 5 years. He said, what do I do next? I said, help him out. Now that we've come up with the remaining expected life of 5 years, let's say the property is worth $100 million. What should you do? Just discount it back 5 years. He said, what discount rate? I said, just use any discount. What does it matter, right? Use a real estate cost of capital if it makes you feel really good. Discount it back and add it in. That is a vacant asset. Not too many companies are going to find that kind of asset lying around, but that's the kind of asset. Yes, they could. You can do. You have to discount back the expected price at the end of 5 years. So you'd apply some kind of real estate price appreciation.
That would be the same as the discount rate.
Not necessarily, right? Real estate price appreciation and the discount rate you apply to get the price appreciation. The cap rate in real estate is not the expected growth rate necessarily in real estate prices, because it's based on some income stream, the fact that you get to live in the property. Because if they converge, you'd have some serious issues with real estate valuation. So you put in a price appreciation and then discount back at a real estate appropriate discount rate. But it will still be a substantial number. It might not be 100 million, it might be 94 million or 96 million. Yeah. That's a classic vacant asset problem. In fact, let me go to that real estate question, because the last time I was in India, I was doing a valuation seminar, actually in Singapore earlier this year. But half the audience were Indians, another third from Southeast Asia, and they all had the same issue. I'll give you a classic example. If you drive through Mumbai, first you're going to be driving really slowly. The traffic is really bad, so you can stop and look around and do all kinds of people watching while you're driving, because you might as well walk. It's about the same speed. Right in the middle of Mumbai, peak real estate value, you'll see a textile factory built 50 or 70 years ago when land was cheap. This textile factory can be valued as a textile factory. Let's put some numbers in. Let's suppose, based on the cash flows as a textile factory, the value that you get is $70 million. So you take the cash flows, you project out the cash. Then you take the land that that factory is on, and you value the land, you come up with $150 million. So this was a classic problem. Every single one of them faced it with some of their companies, one of their companies or more, is which of these two values should I attach to the company? The $70 million that I'm getting from, in fact, I'll give you the three choices. You can do the $70 million, which is a discounted cash flow valuation. You can do the $150 million, which is the real estate value. Or you can do $220 million, which is 70 plus 150. Which is, one of these numbers shouldn't even be there. Which of the three should be off the table right off the top? You can't do the 220. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't say, can I keep my textile factory and sell you the land? It doesn't work that way. So then the question becomes, should I go with the 70 or 150? You answer the question. If you're a passive, if you're thinking about investing in the shares of this company, which one should you pick?
So, would you do the DCF if you're a passive investor and you don't see the possibility?
Basically, you're saying, well, I don't control the company. If I ran the company, I'd make it, you know, so
and
one is.
It depends
yeah.
on things like whether the management interests are like aligned and all that.
In fact, we'll talk about that, because the 70, the conservative passive investor role is say, look, this is not my company. I can think about better uses for the assets. We're starting on our discussion of the value of control now. This is something we're going to dig into later. This is the first aspect of control, is knowing when to let go. This isn't your company. You can tell me what the optimal thing to do is, but if you're a passive investor, you might settle for 70. If you are an acquirer, let's go to the other end of the, you're willing to pay up to? Up to 150. Now let's look at the middle solution. If you're an investor, and you're a realistic investor, not a conservative investor, you've got to make a judgment call, right? And what's a judgment call? Which is, we are starting on it, which is you have to make an assessment of what the likelihood is that this management will come around to its senses. And if there's, let's say, a 50% chance that that'll happen, guess what value you're going to attach to the company? 50% off 70 million plus 50% off 150 million, which will give you 110 million. That's essentially the value control. Jordan.
Taking this out another step, like yeah. what an activist investor would do, and assume like a sale-leaseback.
Yeah, and that's actually a middle ground solution, right? If you have a real estate property, it won't work with a textile factory as much, because it's a land that's more valuable than the building. But if you take New York City, for instance, let's say your headquarters building is in New York City. You need the headquarters still, but real estate prices have gone into a bubble. They're five times higher than they should be. You're sitting in this building saying, what do I do now? Now you can say, why don't you just sell your building? But if you sell your building, there's this pain of having to move all your people to another building and leasing it. But if the prices of real estate have lost connection to the lease and rental payments, here's what you can do to capture the difference. You can sell the building and capture the high price, then lease it back at that unrealistically low lease rate that they're charging you, because they're so caught up in price appreciation, they're not even updating the leases. So rationale for sale leasebacks actually is, if you have real estate that is tremendously overpriced, and that's the judgment you've made, you sell the real estate to capture the price, you lease it back so you can keep your operating assets going, and that difference then goes to the company's stockholders as a one-time gain. So you can already see that real estate can create some real issues. And if you're a company with significant real estate holdings, and that's why I use the hotel example, this can become so distracting that you forget that you're running hotels. Because you're making so many, much money in the real estate, you forget about the fact that people check in, they care about their rooms. You say, who cares about rooms? This is all a real estate play. Which is part of the reason many hotel companies, to avoid that distraction, have done what? They've separated the real estate, and that, I think, is the most sensible thing to do. Because otherwise, you're sitting there as a manager saying, where do I build my next hotel? It's not about where people are going. It's about where the real estate is going to go up the most, right? You forget about the fact that hotels have to be occupied. Who cares? You get to the hottest part of the country, you buy, it's going to go up in value anyway. And there are entire sections of Asia where business is being ravaged by the real estate boom. Every retail company in India is really a real estate play. They don't even care about what they sell anymore. It's horribly run business. It doesn't matter. It becomes indirectly a real estate play, and that means as an investor, you either have to go with that play or step back and say, I don't want a real estate company in my... You're not getting a retail company, you're getting a real estate company. Rajiv? No. So that's any other assets. Now let's move to the complexity issue. Let's assume I come to you with two companies. They look exactly the same in terms of the numbers. Same return on capital, same growth rate, same cost of capital, same operating income. But here's where they're different. The first company is in a single business, has a very simple holding structure. You see exactly what they own. And it's transparent accounting, which means they describe what they do and they're pretty easy to read. That's exactly what they do. The second company is in multiple businesses, has a very complex holding structure. You have special purpose entities, cross holdings, and they have a PIC accounting. You know what a PIC accounting is? It's one of those annual reports you read and you say, what language is this in again? It's written by a combination of a lawyer and an accountant put into one, and they're both bringing out their worst features. It's designed to confound rather than to inform. And we already asked, which one would you value more highly? And we kind of agreed, I think, that the simple company would be valued more highly, which brought, and the first time I thought about this, it led to some soul searching. Because if you look at any valuation book, including mine, nowhere in there is complexity dealt with as an issue, right? In traditional valuation, we assume that what you don't know can't hurt you. Dangerous assumption. But the reason we make that assumption is the diversification argument. You invest in 100 companies you don't know. What do we assume? That what you don't know will cut in both directions and average out. But here's the flaw in that logic when it comes to complex companies. What do you not know? What managers in these companies have chosen not to tell you, right? And let me ask you a follow-up question. What kind of news do managers hold back? Good news or bad news? How many accounting scandals do you wake up to where the accountant says, you know what, guys, we made 5 times more money than we told you we did? When you get a surprise, it's almost always a bad surprise, right? So the genesis for this part of the presentation was when Tyco, about 12 years ago, Tyco was a company that got into accounting problems, grew a lot in the 1990s, but then hit this wall of accounting scandals, dropped 70% in value. So the weeks after Tyco collapsed, GE lost 15% of its value. The question is, why would GE be hurt by Tyco? What did they share in common? They were both companies, conglomerates that grew through acquisitions. Tyco actually used the acquisition process to cover a lot of bad stuff. Investors were saying, how do we know GE is not doing this as well? I was actually in Stanford talking to some GE divisional heads at the time this happened. They said, this is so unfair. We're not Tyco. And I said, what do you expect investors to do? They have to, in a sense, be careful, and they're building in probabilities. So I was teaching my valuation class, and I brought this issue up. And I said, no, if we're going to deal with complexity in valuation, we have to do it better than we're doing right now. But to deal with complexity, there are two questions we need to answer. First is, we need to measure complexity, right? I can't just say, I'll know it when I see it. I need to come up, be able to say, this company is more complex than this one, and here's my measure of it. And second, I have to bring that complexity measure somewhere into my valuation. So here was my first try at measuring complexity. And I have to tell you that my MBAs in that semester were not impressed by this. Here's what I did. I counted the number of pages in the 10Q and the 10K. I know it's incredibly simplistic, but hang in there for a moment. If you wanted to avoid a company to value. Which of these companies are you going to avoid? What the heck is this? 1,026 pages. This isn't War and Peace. This is how many pages it takes them to tell me what happened during 1 year. If it takes you 1,000 pages to tell me what happened, you're one screwed up company. So I put this up and they said, we're not paying. At that point, it was like $140,000 for an MBA. Now it's, what, $200,000 probably with inflation? To count pages. I said, you're so right. What was I thinking? I'll be back next week. And I came back next week with what I call my valuation shit list. That's just my technical term for all the things that really bug me and how much I am capable of turning anything into an Excel spreadsheet. So I take my indignation level, put a score on it, and I, before you know it, you're... So here are some of the things that bug me. A company that claims to be geographically diversified but doesn't tell you where. What the heck does that mean? Or tells you where, but then you take a look at the regions of the world as they describe it, and you've never seen it. It's like a Lord of the Rings universe. What is that? No? Yeah. I still remember a valuation I did of BMW. Yeah. And they break the revenues down to North America, the usual parts of the world, then 13% Oceania. I'm trying to think, where's Oceania? Is it Lost Eye? Might be the lost corner of Atlantis. Maybe they're selling a lot of cars there. And Oceania, of course, included Australia, New Zealand, and Indonesia. I remember asking the investment relations officer, what do they share in common? You know what her answer was? They're all in an ocean. I said, really? So why isn't 85% of the world Oceania? And what you're left with is what, Latvia? I mean, landlocked countries? But you can see why it makes valuation difficult, because if you throw in Indonesia with Australia, what risk premium do I attach to that? So I took all these things that bug me, how much they bug me, and I created. And so the higher the score, the more complex you are as a company. So I came back to class and I said, do you like this more? And they said, yes, yes, this is so much better. And I said, there's one small problem with getting the score, which is to get the score for Citigroup, what do you need to do? Read 1,000 pages. And said, I'm not doing that. But you guys each have a company to value this semester, right? And they could see the train coming at them down the tracks. There's nothing they could do to get out. They said, yes. And I said, this semester I'd like to add one more to-do to your to-do list. In addition to valuing a company, why don't you come up with a complexity score for your company? They bitched and they moaned. But it was their own doing, right? They should have just taken the number of pages in the 10K that I offered them. And they did that semester, actually, in addition to the valuation, they turned in a complexity score. And some very interesting things came through. First is they found zero correlation between company size and complexity. We think large companies are... No, there were some small companies were incredibly complex and large companies were really simple. They found that emerging market companies were about 15 to 20% more complex than developed market companies, mostly because of cross-holding cultures. They found that companies that grew through acquisitions were about 25 to 30% more complex than companies that did not, simply because that goodwill item ravages everything else in your balance sheet. And finally, they found that any company with a capital arm, you know what I'm talking about? GG capital, GMG, was about 30% more difficult to value than a company without a capital. Because basically what you've done is you've embedded a bank inside the company, and it's very difficult to separate the bank from everything else. The least complex, the most transparent company in the entire class that semester was actually an Indian company called Infosys. If you read their annual report, it's an exercise, simple, clear, to the point. So the reason I bring that up is often when I go to emerging markets and talk about complexity, this is what CFOs hide behind. They say, we're an emerging market company, we cannot be transparent. Why? Because the information disclosure laws here are not that good. As if information disclosure laws put a ceiling on what you can reveal, when in fact they put a floor. Nothing stops you from telling me more. So don't hide behind, I'm an Indonesian company, I can't be transparent. Just tell me up front, I don't want to be transparent. And the most complex company in the entire class, it's usually a gimme. Think about a company that grows through acquisitions, has a capital arm, you can't invent this company if you tried. It's GE. Okay? If any of you are valuing GE, it's going to be an exercise in pulling all your teeth out at the same time with no Novocaine. I mean, it's just it's painful. But here's the last piece. Once you get that complexity measure, then you've got to bring it to the valuation. If you're doing a discounted cash flow valuation, there are only three places it can go, right? You can try to change your cash flows, but that's really tough to do. haircut the cash flows for complex companies. You can try to adjust the discount rate. There's some potential there. I actually one time computed the implied equity risk premium. I took the S&P 500 and divided into two halves. Complex half, simple half. Complex half would be the multi-business companies. And I found that the multi-business complex companies had an equity risk premium about 1% higher than the implied equity risk premium for. So you can, if you want to go down that route, you can add 1% of the cost of capital for complex companies. But here's my preferred device. What drives value? The value of growth is whether your return on capital is much higher than the cost of capital, right? So if I see a company earning well above the cost of capital, one of the questions I have to answer is, can they sustain those excess returns, right? And to answer that question, I need to understand the business you're in. I need to understand your company. If you're a complex company and I don't really understand what you do, how the heck can I assume that you can keep making more than your cost of capital for the next decade? So when I have a really complex company and I don't quite get what you do, it's a mystery to me. You make a lot of money, but I have no idea how you do it. I'm not going to change past numbers. I don't know whether you're committing fraud. I can't assume you are. But I'm going to close your excess returns much faster and put the onus back on you. If you want me to give you a higher value, tell me what's different. Let me understand what you do that's special or unique, because then I can let you earn more than the cost of capital. It is the most effective device I've found for smoking out companies to make them reveal more of what they do. One final point is the last throwaway in this paper that I did on complexity. I ran a regression of price-to-book ratios for companies for across 100 largest market cap companies against return equity, beta, and growth, which are pretty traditional variables, and threw in the number of pages in the 10K into the regression. How do I read this coefficient, minus 0.003? Every 100 additional pages in your 10K lowers your price-to-book ratio by 0.3, right? So let's give some valuation advice to Citigroup. What's their price-to-book right now? Like 0.9, it's trading at less than book value. Simple to double it. All they need to do is do what? Knock off 300 pages from your 10K. Sounds facetious, but what are we saying? Focus. There is a price you're paying for this incredibly complex mess that was created in 1998 by John Reed and Sandy Weill coming together and saying, we're going to create something that's everything for everyone. I think companies seriously underestimate how much complexity hurts them. And I'll tell you where this would have the most application. Last week, there were a few people who brought this up at J.P. Morgan's annual meeting that J.P. Morgan would be better off broken up. I firmly believe that money center banks should be broken up, not because of ethics. I'm not an Elizabeth Warren fan saying break them up because of it. I want them broken up because I view them as completely incompetent to run the businesses they've created. I think J.P. Morgan would be worth more as pieces than it is. So if I were a money center bank, I'd be the first one out there saying, I make it sound like I'm doing it for you. When in fact, the best thing that they can do is split them up. Because right now, they're being punished for being incredibly complex messes that nobody understands. I don't see that going away in the near future. Okay, so I'll see you after the break. I'll send an email out tomorrow, day after, but then I'll give you a week of no emails. Enjoy it while you can, because I'll be back, right?
Where did you get the 0.003 coefficient? Is that? Oh, that's the regression.
Okay. All right.
That's the only question I have. Have a good spring break.
I'm part of the second investment fund that we're looking at as an asset manager.